Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The Double X Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Welcome to the Double X podcast for Thursday, July 12th, the unretouched edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, editor of Double X. I am alone in the DC studio, but joined in New York by Allison Benedict, another editor at Double X. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone, who is newly a staff writer at the New Republic, or the New Republic, or, you know, the new something New Republic. I don't really know what to call the new Republic yet, but congratulations. The New Republic. The New Republic.
Now
it's
Noreen.
The New Republic was the first place I ever worked. I have such huge fondness for the New Republic. I have huge fondness for Frank Foer, who has been and is now, again, the editor of the New Republic. So I have so much affection for the place. But it's, like, odd to me that there's, I don't know, it's like back, it's in my past, and now it's got this new, you know, sort of future, Facebook-inspired future. So it doesn't feel like the same thing, but I guess it is the same place. But now it has Noreen, so it's going to be even better.
It's new to me, yeah.
It's new to you. And they're going to have offices in New York and D.C., right? It's
yeah.
It's going to be so exciting.
Yeah.
That's great. Anyway, our 3 topics for today. One is about young women getting their tubes tied and why that's so difficult to do. The second is a slightly alarming sex scene in Louis, the Louis C.K. Half-hour, what is it, a sitcom? I don't know what genre it is. Like,
well, we can talk about that.
We can talk about that. And the third is about 17 Magazine's decision to not touch up photos. That's not exactly right, to not touch up a photo a month, but we'll get into the details of that too. Let's start with the tubes tying. Noreen, you've had your tubes tied, right? I'm just kidding. No. You're like the last person who would ever have their tubes tied.
That might have been a very personal question.
I know. My mom listens to this podcast, guys.
Yeah, okay. Noreen has definitely not had her tubes tied, for all those listeners. This is based on a Slate series that we at Double X ran about women who don't want to have children, and a surprising subtrend emerged during this series, which is that some women so don't want to have children that they want to have their tubes tied. And these are very young women, so women in their 20s and 30s. So we decided to look further into this issue And what we discovered is that this is incredibly difficult to do. And our own Brian Lauder wrote a story interviewing women and doctors about this being very difficult. And the question that emerged is, when a doctor says that a young woman can't have a tubal ligation, is that a typical case of medical condescension, or is that the doctor making a wise decision because the he or she doctor knows that the woman doesn't know what she's talking about? So, Allison, what did you think about these – you with two children think about these young women who have their tubes tied?
Well,
or the doctors?
I think that the question is are they saying no, or are they discouraging women? We got, as you said, we asked readers who chose not to have kids to write in telling us why, and we received many beautifully written, funny, smart essays. And there was this theme that emerged that a lot of young women wanted to have their tubes tied and faced pushback from their doctors. Most of them either were able to accomplish this by lying, coming up with other reasons for wanting to get their tubes tied, or by, you know, seeking out five different doctors and finally the fifth one said yes. But what Brian's piece turned up is that it's a lot about perception, that yes, many doctors do discourage women, particularly young women, from getting sterilized, but it's not necessarily out of some paternalistic impulse. There are actual statistics that show that a lot of women, 20% of women who sterilize before they're 30, end up regretting it later in life. And doctors feel a responsibility to mitigate that regret. So Brian asks a really interesting question in his piece, which is, what do we consider harm? If doctors are tasked to do no harm, is a woman's potential future regret harm? Should doctors prioritize a future woman's feelings over the current woman's feelings? So it's pretty complicated.
Well, and that statistic was so without context. It's like, do people, you know, regret boob jobs or nose jobs? I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of medical procedures that people regret.
And is it any of the doctor's business to care about it?
Well, yeah, I think it is the doctor's business to care about it. Any kind of elective procedure, I want my doctor to walk me through the pros and cons. I mean, that's not to say that they should refuse to do a procedure, but you really, you know, if it's something that they have real concerns about, I think you want them to tell you those concerns. And it's not just sort of the emotional thing. There are, I mean, Brian quoted a couple doctors who said, you know, this just, it seems like you're taking a gun to a knife fight or something. You know, it's really, really unfortunate.
No, that's right. That's a good analogy.
But you
have other options.
You can get an IUD, which works for 5 years and buys you some time. You know, it's not like for guys, you know, getting snipped, which is so easily reversed. It's actually a really, you can get it reversed, but it's not covered by insurance, and it's just really difficult, and it's painful, and it's really invasive. It's as invasive as having a C-section, and so a lot
and apparently doesn't work that well. That's what one of the doctors said.
Yeah, that was interesting too. And so I don't know. It just really seems like even if you are someone who is completely sure that you're not going to have kids, and you know that, and I think by 27 or 28 you probably do know whether you want kids or not. Even if you're completely sure, you know, it just seems like there are less invasive ways and less permanent ways that will give you that out while giving you, you know, that freedom.
I mean, that's true. But if a woman wants to do it, then in the end, isn't it her call? The American Congress of OBGYN say that the guideline is that doctors should provide, you know, intensive counseling to a patient, but that they should not deny it. So what a lot of patients are perceiving perhaps as discrimination or condescension is actually counseling.
Right. That was my question, is like how much of it was a hard refusal. And I mean, this sort of gets into legal questions about like what they are allowed to refuse and what they aren't. But
I really think it's condescension. I would feel more sympathetic if the women were 18, because there is a phase in one's life when one makes a lot of decisions that one is likely to regret, right? Like that older people can look at you and say, you're going to regret that tattoo on your forehead. You really are. I know you think it's an awesome thing to do right now, but you're not going to think that in 10 years.
But the statistics are saying that 20% of these women under 30 are regretting it.
And I think for a different story I was reporting, I talked to a lot of gynecologists who were counseling women to have kids younger than they wanted to if they knew they wanted kids. And that's sort of invasive in a different way, you know, like so it's not, I think that doctors are weighing in and giving women advice on reproductive issues on all sides of it, you know, whether...
I mean, doctors weigh in all the time. Yeah. When you're, you know, when you, after you have a baby and you're breastfeeding, your doctor, your OB is going to give you her opinion on whether she thinks you should go back on the pill.
So why is it so much more condescending to have the doctor say, I don't think you should do this, versus having the doctor say, you should have kids now. I don't care if you think, you know, your fertility will last for 10 years. I guess I don't find it any more condescending than any other thing.
Also, as you know, doctors weigh in, like, they never weigh in like this. They'll say, you know, doctors famously won't give you a clear marker on, you know, what are the consequences of the medical decisions you're likely to make. In my experience, doctors have gotten ever more slippery about saying, you know, well, this is the percent chance of this. This is a percent chance of this. I feel like underlying this decision gets back to the reason we ran this series in the first place. It has to do with people's general disgust and feeling that it's utterly unnatural for a woman to not want to have children. That at some level they just think that's wrong, and they're, you know, they find that slightly repulsive.
I don't think people think it's wrong. I think that there is more acceptance of that than there used to be. I think there's just a moment of surprise, and people are just surprised to see someone be so sure about that at a young age. Like, I have often, you know, if I have a friend who says very definitively, I don't want kids, I sort of marvel at her sureness about what she wants in life. And I think that's wonderful. But I am, like, I am caught aback more so than I am when someone says definitively, I do want kids, you know?
I think there's still taboo. I don't think it's quite as overt anymore. But I think it still exists. I wouldn't ever question someone's choices to their face or say, you know, oh, you'll come around. But I might think it in the back of my head. I have to say
our series has a little bit, like, helped in the way that I wanted it to. Like, reading a lot of these very moving essays which had a pretty clear reason for not wanting to have children has really done a number on my head in terms of that little reserve of judgment that I have against people who don't want to have children. It's more and more coming to seem to me like a completely legitimate choice. Like, people have reasons for it. You know, they can articulate those reasons, and fine.
It is a legitimate choice. Part of the reaction or personal reaction to it is like a justification of your own decisions.
Right.
That it's hard to understand how the one of the largest decisions you've made in your life that you can, you know, only in a big sense think about as the right one, why other people wouldn't choose it.
Right. Noreen, do you have a lot of friends who don't want to have children?
I have a handful, yeah.
And do you think they really know?
I don't think anyone really know. I don't, you know.
Are they coupled
I did not
up?
Have
Are
a they... single friend. I do not remember a single person when I was your age saying they didn't want to have kids.
Well, you know,
none of my friends.
You know what is interesting is you do read more and more stories now about how having children makes you unhappy. And, like, the logical choice, if you are someone who, like, really enjoys, you know, your urban child-free life, and, you know, it is a logical choice to not want to have kids if you know you're not going to make a ton of money, if you, you know, feel certain ways about overpopulation or whatever the reasons might be. There are, like, a million reasons for people not to want to have kids, and I think maybe that seeped through. But I do know people who very definitively say, I don't want to have kids. And, you know, I am someone who, like, thinks that she does want to have kids, and I look at them, and it seems like a freeing thing to know that, right? So you don't have to wrestle with all sorts of complications or anticipate all sorts of complications in relationships and job choices and geographic things.
Although it's very, I mean, I imagine that if you are single and you don't want to have kids and you face ahead, like, looking for a partner that agrees with that.
That's very complicated.
That is complicated.
Yeah.
I also think when you're 26 now, it's almost like when you were 18, 30 years ago. A 26-year-old now might change their mind when it comes to 39.
Right, and she'll have medical options that will let her do. Yeah, right. I think that's, yeah, there was an essay in Salon a year ago from a 27-year-old who had decided to have her tubes tied, and she was married, and it was a decision she'd made with her partner. But it seemed as if he, on one level, wanted kids, and I sort of left that essay wondering if that would all still be okay down the line for them. And I hope it is, and, you know, I'm sure it is, but there was that lingering question, you know?
Well, that was an interesting part of the story we ran in Slate, was at the end, Brian quoted a survey of gynecologists who were presented with hypothetical situations. And so it seemed to be that it wasn't just rank generic condescension, depending on the woman's situation. Was her husband supportive? How old was the woman? Did she already have children? Did she have one child or many children? The gynecologist seemed to give the woman different advice. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure if that was, you know, maybe that's just common sense. Like maybe that's just, you know, common life sense and it's fine for the doctor to do that. It wasn't that they thought all the women were wrong, but they thought certain women in certain situations.
And I think age was the biggest factor. There was another piece online that I read, a woman, I think she was 21 and her husband was 23 and they already had two kids and she wanted to have her tubes tied and her doctor didn't just discourage her but turned her down because she was so young. And that to me did feel different. Like, well, she's got two kids. I guess I believe her that she's done.
Right.
I mean, did feel differently about
that. If it were a single 21-year-old who said that, I think we all would feel like, okay, like...
I agree. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm calling my own.
Well, so do you guys know friends who said... Well, Hanna, you said you didn't know anyone who didn't want...
Nobody. But I mean, even women who had, like, a lot of trouble with men, like, I sort of suspected they weren't going to get married. They mm-hmm. all said they would have kids. And I've got friends who are in the sperm bank baby phase of their life now. So that, indeed, when I knew them in college, I suspected they wouldn't get married. They didn't get married, but they still have kids.
Hmm.
So it still seemed like a fairly unnatural choice to say you weren't going to have children. It's just not something anybody articulated, whereas I think now people can articulate it.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I knew plenty of people in early 20s who said they didn't want to have kids, and most of them are having them now. Although my brother-in-law and sister-in-law are in their late 30s and early 40s, and have, since I met them, said they weren't having kids. They've been married for 15 years, maybe, and they have not had kids, and they're not going to.
And I admire that, damn it. 10 years into my child rearing, I admire that. Okay, let's move on to our second topic, which is Louis C.K.'s show. But before we do that, I would like to say a word about our sponsor, our very loyal sponsor, which is Audible. Longtime listeners of the XX podcast and other podcasts will know that Audible is one of the leaders of digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the internet. You can choose from more than 100,000 audiobooks and listen to them on practically any device, including the one that you're using to listen to us right now. We mostly listen to Audible off of my phone in the car, and we love it very much and have listened to dozens and dozens of books. The book I'm going to recommend this week, which was going to be my coffee talk, but I chose a different one, is Gillian Flynn's book, Gone Girl, which we are going to do in a future – we are likely to do in a future audio book club on Slate.
I recommended that a few weeks ago.
Oh, you did? Excellent.
Yes.
So there you go. So the thing that's cool is that the Audible version, this is a mystery. This is a mystery about a marriage, and that's all I'll say about it. But it's got a huge amount of buzz, and the audio version is the wife's part is read by a woman, and the husband part is read by a man, which I've never seen before. Usually they do it just by having actors do it. So you should – that can be your first book that you download. For XX listeners who are not already Audible members, Audible is offering a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX, not XX, but slash the whole words XX spoken out. So go there today, and you can also receive a free subscription to either The Times or The Wall Street Journal. Okay, our second topic, Louis C.K. We had complaints on a recent podcast about spoilers and Brave, and I regret having said so much about Brave so soon after the movie come out. I don't know what to do on this one. There's really no way for us to talk about this Louis C.K. segment without mentioning lots of details, and the scene we're about to discuss happens fairly late in the episode. So if you haven't seen it, if you've DVR'd it, if you're going to watch it later, I don't know what to say. You just have to skip this segment and come back to it later because we've just got to get into the details. So there is a sex scene in the truck that happens late in this episode. And basically, Louis has been set up by his friends with a woman named Lori. And they at first have a very awkward meeting, which develops into a kind of chemistry, a sort of sexy, flirtatious, but dark chemistry. And then they end up in a truck together. And this is where the episode breaks new ground in sexual aggressiveness, I would say, on the part of women, and re-examines the question of the double standard in a really interesting new way. I will just say how the scene starts out, which is that they're sitting together in the truck. And she says, "Whip it out. Let me blow you." So, which is what I always say on a first date. So, Noreen, Did you find this scene, you know, refreshing and liberating in the mode of Girls and all its, you know, the HBO show Girls and all its odd sex scenes? Or did you find it just, like, totally horrifying?
I found it neither. I just found it to be really interesting television. I think we have to explain what happens after that. So after she goes down on him, she asks him to reciprocate in a pretty, like, what does she say? She says,
put on your feed bag.
Put on your feed bag, yep.
And she basically, like, leans back as if she's adjusting her crotch.
Yeah, and the pickup truck, we should say, is hers. She is she's sort of this no-nonsense woman who has her own contracting business, I believe. It's just, you know, she's presented as this, you know, very confident, almost masculine woman.
And slightly, I mean, she's not meant to be appealing. You're not meant to want to be her. She's unappealing in many ways.
I don't think until this part I found her unappealing.
Yeah, I thought she was sort of cool, and then this was a whole other thing. But so he says no. He says, sorry, that's an intimate thing. I don't think, you know, I don't feel comfortable doing that. And she then essentially, she makes a bet with him. She says, you know, within 5 minutes, you'll be going down on me. I'll bet you $1,000. And then she first says, oh, I know why you didn't want to do it. You're gay. And he doesn't take the bait. And
that's so awesome.
And so she punches the, was it his face or the window behind?
She slams his head into the car window.
And then sort of.
And breaks the window, shatters.
Breaks
it.
The window and essentially, like, forces herself.
She climbs her on top of him and puts her vagina on top of his mouth.
Right. So, presumably it ends well for her. And so then the punchline of the whole thing is they're done, and she goes, so am I going to see you again? And he's like, yeah, sure. You know, just sure, of course. So I thought this was really fascinating, and I have to admit that when I saw the scene, I didn't think first off that it was a date rape scene. And I feel like an idiot for not thinking of it in those terms, but I think because it was a role reversal, I didn't think of it that way. I just sort of thought about, you know, the question of reciprocity on this act and, like, the way that people think of it differently for men and women. I thought it was a really interesting way that he approached that. So I neither found it horrifying. As Allison, I think I read your thing. That was where you were pretty horrified that it was, like, a date rape scene that was treated somewhat lightly. And I don't think there was another blog post on Slate from Alyssa Rosenberg saying that it was sort of this great feminist moment, and I didn't feel that way either. It just seemed like an interesting way of pointing out certain realities about the way human beings have sex.
I actually didn't think it was treated lightly. Mm-hmm. I also loved the episode. Mm-hmm. I thought it was great television. I just think it's been taken lightly. The reaction to the episode has kind of confounded me.
You pointed out that there was a gif that made the rounds of her slamming him and that into the window, and that was sort of gross.
Yeah, yeah, imagine the Charlie Sheen. Like, imagine if there was if there was the Charlie Sheen version from Anger Management where he's slamming a woman's head into the window.
That doesn't mean I'm offended by the episode. I can't say what Louis C.K. intends us to take away from this. I don't think that's it, though. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of male critics saw the truck scene as a really brilliant and brutal joke set up in Punchline. And a lot of female critics loved the scene for how tough the Melissa Leo character is, you know, finally this sexually aggressive,
age-appropriate.
Right. Well, no bullshit, says what she wants.
She's older than he is. That's an interesting thing. In real life, she's, you know, maybe half a decade older than he is, and she looks older on screen. And Louis C.K. has talked a lot about how he likes to date women who are his contemporaries. He has a whole bit in his stand-up about how he dates, you know, he prefers women over girls. And so I thought that was an interesting thing that was going on here. You know, you mentioned Girls before, Hannah, but this seems, in a weird way, like an answer to that. Like, she was so sure of what she wanted, right? Like, it was like...
Right, there's Jessa in Girls who also will, like, take whatever sex she can get,
but you're not
sure
that she wants it.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so this seemed like he was doing a thing where he was like, okay, like, what if hookup culture were enacted by people who actually knew what they wanted and weren't, like, sort of having these messy feelings around it? What if it was just this exchange by a really confident pair of people? I mean, that's a weird reading of this, but I couldn't help thinking that it was some sort of answer to that.
I mean, that's how I was viewing it until she bashes his head. I mean, honestly, that's how, you know, she's awesome. That's empowering. But then, I mean, her rage
bashing someone's head isn't awesome.
Right. And I don't think – and the notion that, like, her rage is somehow justifiable because of the, you know, catcalls and grabby hands we've all had to endure, I'm not buying that.
But it was a joke. Like, that – I mean
– I don't think it was a joke. I mean, that show is –
Not a joke in the traditional, like, setup, like, punchline joke, but the whole scene was meant to be a surreal sort of –
But it was, you know, you guys are reading as confidence what I read slightly as revenge. I mean, her talk right before she says that to him is about, you know, I've been a good girl. I've given my share of blowjobs. And then he implies basically that once she did give him a blowjob, he thought she was kind of slutty. Like, you know, right. Maybe it what was, many guys would think. So he, right. so the dynamic that would prevail, say, in the college hookup culture gets articulated at some point in the date, but they're obviously much, much older. Mm-hmm. So she's kind of over that dynamic, you know? Like, yeah. That's the way she's lived her life, and now she's thinking, screw it. Like, that dynamic pisses her off. So she slams his head, and she's like, well, I'm not doing that anymore. Like, I'm not 19, you know? So that's where she becomes slightly horrifying, I think. You know, like Charlize Theron kind of, you know.
I also think what's kind of confusing about the episode, and maybe this is a, you know, maybe this is success, I'm not sure, but it's not, the whole episode is set up as a gender reversal. That date scene is bookended by two scenes of Louis at the dinner table with his two daughters playing Mr. Mom. Or not playing Mr. Mom, being Mr. Mom. Mm-hmm. I mean, he made them dinner, he's clearing the dishes, he complains at the end about nobody thanks me for making you this lovely meal and doing all the work around the house. So the whole thing is about gender reversal, but in that and she, you know, she has this landscaping business. She's mm-hmm. a breadwinner. She says, like, I don't want to get married. I don't need another mouth to feed.
Yeah.
Well, he's, you know, some freelance comic. But the scene in the truck is not a full gender reversal, as I think Willa Paskin wrote in Salon, which is, to her, what makes it a lot more complicated. To me, it makes it a lot more
Can
hard to wrap my
that?
Head around.
What do you mean? What do you mean? Can you explain? Why is that scene different from what's going on in the rest of the episode? Because she's got the physical, because she's the physical aggressor. No, but that is gender reversal.
But he is sort of acting as a dude would. He got what he wanted, and then he's done.
Right. So you identify with her as the woman in the part that you were just talking about, Hannah, that she's been giving these blowjobs for how many years? And now, you know, she's been doing what she's been asked. And then it switches, and she's abusive.
But another thing that Willa pointed out that I thought was interesting, if she'd been like, okay, let's have sex now, he would have been like, all right, but because it was, you know, oral sex, he found it more intimate than he would have found plain old regular sex, you know?
I thought that part was brilliant to me, their mm-hmm. conversation about intimate, like which oral sex is more intimate and why it was, you know, automatically assumed that for him it would be like too intimate and could only happen on the 15th date,
right.
Whereas a blowjob is not that intimate. That was really interesting.
Right. And that sort of felt like a response to hookup culture, like that sort of valuation of different acts at different points in the exchange, the transaction. That felt really interesting.
It's also interesting to think about how Louis in this scene relates to other Louis. I mean, Louis on it, doing stand-up, whether – I don't know who I'm talking about here. The real guy, Louis C.K. doing stand-up, or the guy in the Comedy Cellar at the beginning of the episodes doing stand-up. But, I mean, he's, you know, he'll masturbate to anything. All, you know, he does not seem like the guy who would turn this down.
Right. And he, you know, there was an episode last season that I kind of kept thinking about where it's called Blueberries. It's a scene with, he dates, this woman who has children in the same school as his children sort of invites him to her place to have sex. And it's like the least sexy thing ever, right? Like, it's just this complete exchange of goods and services. She sends him to the store to buy things for her, including blueberries. And she has sort of like, she just seems really sad and, but also very much like a matron. Like, she puts on a nightgown before they have like a not a sexy nightgown, like a, you know, your grandma's nightgown. And so I think he is playing with these ideas of like what women want when they get older and they are more sure of themselves, but in what way, you know? So he's playing around with that.
And what being a middle-aged single man is probably like.
And being a middle-aged single woman, actually, maybe more interestingly.
And then he ends the episode by saying about his daughter, "I'm her first asshole," which was really funny, like just a recognition that these dynamics continue. It was a really great episode. The whole gorilla thing, which has nothing to do with us, you know, with what we're talking about, was also really great. I mean, how his daughter was the muse for his jokes.
Oh,
you know?
So we should explain the gorilla thing. I guess if people have seen it, they've seen it. But it was like a sort of... yeah, he repeats. Well, you had a little riff on this, or maybe Patton Oswalt did in the Slate dialogue, but he repeats a joke that his daughter had told him, a really completely absurd joke, and he sort of makes her all the more funnier by letting us see it through adult eyes or
and
something.
The joke is basically, and I think the daughter says, you know, who didn't let the gorilla into the ballet? And he says, who? And she says, the people who make that decision.
Yeah, it's really impossible to explain why it's funny. Okay, let's move on to our third topic. So 17 Magazine recently published something called the Body Peace Treaty, which was written by its editor, whose name is Anne Schokit or Schokit. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. After a campaign run by a 14-year-old girl in Maine asking 17 Magazine to run at least one unretouched photo in the magazine every month, 17 decided that they would live up to the campaign. And in her letter, the editor writes things like, "We want to show more real girls in the magazine and have more real girls have pictures basically that girls can identify with." And so they showed a before and after picture in the editor's letter. And in the before picture, the girl was sort of swung back wearing a little miniskirt, had her hair kind of flyaway hair and her bra strap showing. In the after picture, this stuff was all cleaned up. Now, there's a great history of unretouched photos. This is the birthing of Jezebel starts with an unretouched photo that they paid somebody to run. Who was the photo of? I was trying to remember who the photo was.
It was Faith Hill, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, it was.
That they bought from the photo department of someone. And there's something actually quite cool about unretouched photos because, I don't know, it seems renegade to run an unretouched photo of a celebrity. It seems like a cool thing to do. I have totally different feelings about what it was like in 17 Magazine and what that campaign is all about. But in general, I'm a fan of forcing, you know, the unretouched photo. It does feel rebellious. Although in this case, I was not down with this crusade, as I wrote in a blog post that people thought was really bitchy and mean to this 14-year-old girl. Have either of you read 17 Magazine in a while or like looked at it?
Not in many years.
I went on their website in preparation for this and it looked really familiar. It looked like, you know, the past, you know, 10 years since I was 17. Probably didn't really read 17 when I was 17, but the past 10 or 20 years, it's been the same thing, you know? It just felt very familiar.
I think I got a different idea about what the Body Peace Treaty actually is proposing or that they agreed to do. I thought that they said they will never change girls' body shapes or faces, but that they never have. So they're like just sort of going to continue not to do that and that they'll be more transparent about photo retouching, which means they will show the process on a Tumblr maybe, but they still are going to retouch bra straps and wispy hair.
Which seems fine to me. I don't know if I believe them that they've never touched, you know, girls' bodies or faces. I do think probably if you're using teenage models as opposed to a 40-year-old actress, you probably do have to do less retouching in general of you know, that angles. Sort of thing to get a perfect image. But I'm not totally sure that they're being completely honest there.
I kind of loathe the idea that we all feel like we have to see a picture of ourselves reflected back
at us. I can't stand it. It drives me crazy. Like, I feel like I love the unretouched photo because it's kind of guerrilla theater. It's like street protest. Like, that's a cool thing for Jezebel to have done back in the day, like publish this photo, just sort of stake its claim against the women's magazine establishment. But it's a completely different thing for the magazine to then adopt that ethos or pretend to adopt that ethos and display it in its pages. Like, fashion magazines are for a kind of aesthetic, right? Like, we accept that's what fashion magazines are. They're aspirational. You're supposed to see pictures of people who look better than you do and are wearing clothes that are nicer than the clothes you wear, and that's what fashion magazines are about. And there might have been a day in which we were lacking for outlets for us to see real people or unretouched photos. But this is not that day. Like, I mean, there's like a zillion blogs in which you can see like street fashion. You can see any kind of photo of any kind of person that you want. Like, I don't see why it feels, you know, manipulative that we have to, you know, we have to foist that on 17 magazine, which with its like smiley faces and exclamation points. But I'm not a 17-year-old girl.
Right.
Maybe it's still oppressive. Like maybe they still have the same oppressive hold over a 17-year-old girl that they ever did. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's my one major pushback against this is that we aren't 17 and being, you know, you're probably not 17 when you're reading 17. You're probably about 12, you know, and you are not self-confident and you probably spend hours looking at those pictures and it feels really shitty if you don't look like those people, right? But I imagine that it has less of a hold than it used to. But, you know, one thing I will say about like YouTube and live journals and all the other ways that girls have to sort of like express themselves and even things like Rookie. Like, have you ever watched any of those tutorials on like how to do your hair on YouTube? Have you ever done that? I've done that. I wanted to learn how to give myself a blowout, you know, with my hair. And so I ended up on some like, you know, 15-year-old girl's YouTube channel and she did a perfect blowout. And it, in a way, it was incredibly, if I had been a 13-year-old girl or whatever, that would have been even more intimidating than seeing the professional women able to do it, you know, with like an army of stylists. It was just like some girl in her room who had perfect hair and was spending her life like showing, you know, everyone else how to perfect themselves. So I don't think it like the you know, the ability to see like real people is always super confidence boosting for the regular 17 target reader.
I think the question is also like whose responsibility is does you know, a glossy magazine does not have the same social responsibility that a newspaper does, and they do have a responsibility to their employees, which is why I would support any campaign to stop them from hiring incredibly thin and unhealthy models, but it does seem naive to think the goal of these magazines is to do what's best for their readers. They're selling products.
Well, and I do think that, like, if you pick up a 17 magazine, it's going to be very different than picking up a Vogue. They are selling self-confidence in a way that Vogue is not. And they are doing that as part of their product already. They do feature sort of fresh-faced models and fairly wholesome, you know, outfits on them. They it's in their self-interest to sort of promote teen self-confidence, and I think they're already doing that. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe suddenly, you know, it's all like Terry Richardson photo shoots of like naked writhing Ukrainian 13-year-olds, but I don't think that's what's going on. I think it's sort of an apple-cheeked blonde girl wearing
that's
American
a really good point. I never thought about that. That is part of their mission. I mean, when I read this body piece treaty, it strikes you as also false because it's all about, you know, you be the best that you can be. It's like Oprah for 12-year-olds, you know, it's all about self-confidence. But then maybe that's like the central narrative of a, you know, preteen teen's life, and that is what 17 magazine is packaging. And so there is something more sincere about their commitment to not make girls feel bad about themselves.
Yeah, I think the target,
which is like if Anna Wintour said that, you'd be like, yeah, right. You know, like if Anna Wintour of editor of Vogue said, you know, I'm going to show real girls in my like you just
well, she said that she's not featuring super skinny models anymore, which
that's
is
different
of-
that's like an employee thing. Right. And I'm just saying if she right. if she, you know, if she said that same thing that the editor of 17, that is the difference between 17 as a fashion magazine and a grown-up fashion magazine.
Right.
So I have if this campaign had come from a young black girl who was saying that everyone, like you just said, everyone's apple-cheeked and blonde, you didn't say that in a negative way, but would you feel differently about it? Because that's where it hits me as to myself as hypocritical. Like, I'm inclined to say, like, relax, girl.
Yeah.
You know, like, everyone doesn't have to look like you. It's okay. It's a glossy magazine.
Yeah, you are seeing a version of yourselves reflected
right.
back there.
But when it comes to if it would be the same question about show, you know, reflecting back a certain diversity, I think I would be more inclined to kind of support that campaign. And I'm not sure what that's about.
I think that makes sense to me.
Why?
Why? I mean, again,
I'm not sure why it makes sense.
I don't want to disparage 17 because, again, I haven't read it in more than a decade. And I do think probably that they make an effort to have their models be diverse. But I think that having an aspirational – if we're accepting the fact that fashion magazines are aspirational, everyone should, you know, see a version of themselves in that, you know, that and that comes back to the, you know, girls who are a little heavier should see a version of themselves. Girls who are different ethnicities should be able to see a version of themselves. I buy that as an argument.
Yeah, I feel like Lena Dunham has kind of retrained my mind about these things. You know, she's so kind of self-confident about showing herself and her body. I mean, not really. She also talks about why she doesn't like it. But
make everything about girls.
I know.
How are you surviving in the off-season? What are you going to do between now and...
I really have to stop. I promise this will be my last Lena Dunham reference
I wonder if Lena Dunham tied her, too.
What about Rookie? I feel like Rookie is the reference.
Rookie.
Here.
Okay, yeah. So I should have said Rookie, which was the second thing in my mind. Like, to me, Tavi, you know, she's an odd, eccentric character who is not, by anybody's standards, classically beautiful, who has a very particular aesthetic, which has been co-opted by the fashion industry, but never mind. Her magazine Rookie definitely has that, you know, rah-rah, self-confidence, you-go-girl kind of voice, but it also has a particular eccentricity, which I really appreciate. So, you know, if 17 magazine could truly expand its notion of what beauty is and what's cool and what real girls are like, that would be great, you know, like beyond just wholesomeness. I think that would be really interesting and cool. And Rookie, I don't read I've read Rookie now and again, but I don't read it regularly enough to see how much it's kept that up. But like, if I were this 14-year-old girl, what I would do is stop reading 17 and start reading Rookie or some of these.
I mean, that's what happened when
we
were younger, right? There was 17 and then there was Sassy. Yeah. I mean, there's room.
Yeah, there's room. Different girls want to read different things.
Right. Okay. Excellent. That's how we'll conclude it, by talking about what we would like to read, us girls. So let's go on to our Coffee Talk recommendations. Allison, why don't you go first today?
Okay, so there's a little debate online happening right now about whether binge-watching television is good or bad, and I am on the side of good. So I'm going to recommend, if you haven't seen it already, and I won't spoil anything, but the new season of Homeland is starting in, I think, the beginning of September, which is not so far away. So if you want to catch up on the season, the first season beforehand, you should start now. You can get it on Showtime On Demand, I'm assuming.
I'm going to take your advice because I need a new show to watch because I'm girls deprived. So I'm going to take your advice and watch
it. Much better than girls. Much better than girls. Start.
Everybody's told me how good it is. I just haven't like gotten it together to watch it.
We should ask readers what someone who's feeling deprived, girls deprived, should watch, because there are other television shows. Oh, our producer is raising his hand.
I recently rewatched the entirety of Daria, and that show holds up incredibly well as a great, strong female lead substitute for girls.
I actually never seen Daria. I feel like it's a gaping hole in my cultural education. I should probably do that.
Run, don't walk to Daria.
Well, because I am high-minded and don't binge-watch television, this is not true. I have binge-watched many different shows, not all of them girls. I'm really, really interested in talking about Sheila Hetty's How Should a Person Be, which hopefully we will do a book club on. And I just edited Katie Royfe's piece, and she called it equally compelling and irritating. And I really liked it. And since I've really liked it, I've been made to feel sort of unsophisticated for really liking it. And now I just really want to talk to everybody about it. So that's what I want to
recommend. So I have read, I think, every single review of that book. And I don't want to read it.
Yeah,
like even the raves made me feel like I didn't want to read it. So I want you to explain to me why you enjoyed it so much. Like, it just felt like plotless.
It's completely plotless. It's just about friendships. It is, I think, a very unique perspective. I mean, if we were talking about Tavi, it's like she's just very eccentric, and the way she sees the world is fairly eccentric. And the whole idea of writing a book of philosophy, which makes it sound boring, but a book in which she's thinking hard about ideas like art, but writing them through you know, conflicts that she has with her friends about them both buying the same yellow dress and how annoying that is. It's just a very particular perspective, which I really, really appreciated. And she's not like hammering in feminist themes or like women's creativity or why female friendships are like this or why her marriage fell apart. All the things that are usually thought of as important, she glosses over. And really what you're just doing is living with her voice. And it's not that long a book, and it's actually not that difficult to read. I feel like the reviews make it feel like labor, and it really is not labor to read. It's a very light touch that she has.
The most interesting comparison, I think, was in David Hagelin's review, which wasn't for Slate but for The Times, and he said that she's talked explicitly in interviews about owing a debt to Lauren Conrad and The Hills, and that sort of intrigued me, because like a highbrow Hills sounds kind of great.
It's not even that highbrow. It's not that highbrow. It's this weird highbrow lowbrow mix. It's really not highbrow.
All right. You've convinced me.
There's like a lot of pop culture references, and like she's just not that highbrow a person.
Okay.
Anyway, I really liked it.
Well,
Noreen.
I've been reading Nora Ephron, Book of Essays. I've been reading Wallflower at the Orgy. And many of these I'd read just online in the New York Magazine archives before, but I'd never actually read this particular collection of Nora Ephron's. And I'm a really big Nora Ephron fan, and I was really sad to see her passing, or to read about her passing. And this book is just great. It's most of these essays she wrote when she was around my age. She was 27 and 28 and 29, and she was such a sure-footed writer that it's and just so funny and smart and charming and mean in the best way, which is not really mean at all. And so this Wallflower at the Orgy is a great collection of essays. And I tried to order Crazy Salad. Have you guys read Crazy Salad? It's out of print.
A long time ago.
It's out of print, and there are 90 holds on it at the New York Public Library for one copy. So if anyone has advice on how I can not pay $100 on Amazon and read Crazy Salad, let me know. I'm sure they'll be reissuing it.
I love that it seems like she is right now being remembered most for her writing and not for her movies. It's kind of interesting how that, like, the legacy.
It is, yeah. Because I think it's that, like, people felt like her writing was so good and had been forgotten, and everyone knows When Harry Met Sally, right, and all the big, you know, and this felt like, you know, this was her B-sides or something, yeah, but not really B-sides.
Since I vowed not to mention Girls or Lena Dunham in subsequent podcasts, I'm going to get my last mention in now, which is that Lena Dunham wrote a great in memory of Nora Ephron about the brief friendship, which was ran in the New Yorker, which was extremely charming.
She did, and that was actually one of my favorite things, where a number of female writers wrote remembrances in which they revealed that Nora Ephron had been incredibly encouraging of them on a personal level. She just reached out and said, you know, let me take you to lunch or whatever, and just been sort of an angel in their careers, which I thought was just wonderful.
Not just that, but was sort of like a Yenta in your life. Like, here's the best orthodontist you should go to, and, you know, Patagonia makes the best jacket, you know, like that. She was that kind of person for a lot of people, which was very cute to hear about.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that is all for today. Thank you, listeners, for tuning into the podcast. Thank you to Chris Wade for engineering and also piping in on his favorite binge-watching television, which we hope all you readers will also, I mean, listeners will also pipe in on the Facebook page. Thank you to Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all Slate podcasts. And as usual, please log on to our XX Facebook page. Tell us what TV I should binge watch now that I can't watch Girls, and also what we should talk about in the next podcast. And we will see you in 2 weeks. Bye.
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 Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com. Save big.